Good morning, friends on the radio. Welcome to the conversation. My name's Graham. Thrilled to be your host today. Looking forward to having a chat with you. Last couple weeks, I think we're sort of softballs. Kind of like New Year's resolution style. This week, we're going to do something different, and it could be the start of a multi-part conversation. We could end up talking about this one for a couple weeks, I bet. And that's culture. Before we get into culture, welcome to the show. We've been starting things off with an icebreaker lately. The number to call is 503-325-0010. Our icebreaker is just a way to make sure that our phone system's working to get everybody used to calling. And it's just kind of fun. It's kind of goofy. Today's icebreaker is... You know, there's so many to choose from. It's always a challenge. Let's go with this. If you could be friends with a cartoon character, which cartoon character would you want to be friends with? 503-325-0010. We'll see how that one hits. So today we're exploring the concept of culture. What is culture? What does it mean? What are your favorite aspects of culture? One of the things that I'm curious about is if an alien anthropologist were to study the Earth and study humans, what aspects of culture would you be most proud to show them? Or what aspects of culture would you be embarrassed by? This foray into culture was prompted by a gift that I received from a fellow staff member, one who knows me very well, one whose voice you just heard, Joanne. She gave me a book called The Cultural Lives of Whales and Dolphins. She knows that I've got an interest in cetaceans. And so it's been a really interesting book so far. I'm only a few pages in. It's very dense. It's very, it's more of a textbook. And they definitely lay out right at the beginning that this is not to be confused with the folks who think of dolphins and whales as, smarter than any human, or it's a mystical relationship or telepath. You know, this is very much a textbook of sorts. And one of the things that they establish at the beginning of the book is that there's a lot of different definitions of culture. And they seem to put it in the context of genetics versus transmitted information or behaviors after birth. And that when culture takes its hold, everything kind of changes. And it can have an effect on genes. Let me see if I can't find a couple of examples of definitions of culture that they talked about. There's a range of them, from the simple, like culture is the transfer of information by behavioral means, to more complex ones like the mass of learned and transmitted motor reactions, habits, techniques, ideas, and values, and the behavior they induce. The next one is Edward Taylor's widely cited concept of culture as that complex whole which includes knowledge, belief, art, morals, law, custom, and any other capabilities and habits acquired by humans as a member of society. In colloquial speech, culture is used in two principal ways: a very general, culture is the way we do things, and a more pretentious, intellectual and artistic activity. So the way we do things includes simple attributes, like how we greet each other and how we eat, as well as the side of the road we drive on, or our language. And then the higher concept of culture, high culture, is more restrictive to religion, poetry, opera, and the like. And the author thinks that the second type of culture, high culture, is usually considered a sign of sophistication, but from their perspective, it's a subset of culture in general. And arguably, while it's more elaborate than the first definition, it's also less important. But the basic idea of culture seems to be about learning from each other, but there may be additional requirements. Is a recipe for granola culture? What about a route for driving downtown to avoid traffic jams? Is that culture? So that's what we're exploring today. What do you think culture is? What are aspects of culture? You know, there's kind of a long list there in one of those definitions. See if I can find it again. Knowledge, belief, art, morals, law, custom, and any other capabilities and habits acquired by man as a member of society. Looks like we've got someone with some ideas about culture on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Graham. This is Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Hey, good morning. I'm thinking we're talking about probably two different issues here. One's nature versus...
nurture.
Yeah, culture versus nature. And culture is only one generation deep. If you lose the people or your society that is teaching you their culture... that culture is gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you see these animals that are in zoos. Their culture is gone. You take a zoo animal born in a zoo and turn it loose in the wild, it has no clue. It has no idea that it's a wild animal and what it's supposed to do. Until, like an elephant, for example, if they turn an elephant loose with other elephants, they will teach it what it needs to do, and an elephant's capable of learning that stuff. But if you take a wild human, for example, and put that wild human into a culture such as ours, they'd be lost.
Yeah.
They'd absolutely be lost. When explorers go into jungle tribes in South America, they have to be very careful because they don't understand that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for example, that one young man who was going to preach the word of God to this tribe somewhere in the archipelago of Indonesia somewhere a few years ago. And they filled him full of arrows. They didn't want to hear anything about that stuff. Remember that? That was in the news not too long ago.
I missed that story. That's kind of amazing.
2 or 3 years ago, this guy, he was a young fellow. I believe he was from Oregon.
Wow.
He was possessed with a spirit, so he's going to go rescue these guys who have been happily in their own culture for millennia. And they tried to tell him to back off, and he showed up waving a Bible in the air, and they killed him. And they left him laying on the beach, and there was some discussion about trying to go in there and punish the tribe and this and that and the other thing. And they elected not to because it was invading their culture. And their culture, primitive as though it is that's theirs. And maybe they're the last wild humans on Earth. They really didn't need to be toyed with. So that's just an example. Yeah. Civilization is only one generation deep, so like a thin veneer. You peel it off, and it's chaos.
Yeah, that's interesting. The book did mention that, you know, aspects of culture can be almost genetic in their longevity. They're rare, but you're right. If nobody is exposed to it, it is gone in an instant.
Absolutely. Nature versus nurture, basically, you know. Okay, well, that's my contribution.
All right, well, what about your any cartoon characters you'd want to hang out with?
Oh, yeah, Yogi Bear, man. I dig Yogi Bear. He's always looking for the picnic baskets.
That's a good one.
All right.
Take care, Jim.
All right, bye now.
If you'd like to join the conversation, 503-325-0010. going on talking a little bit more about what culture is, establishing some definitions here. Culture is central to anthropology, art history, some areas of psychology, archaeology. It's also studied by sociologists, biologists, economists, and historians. And a scholar's definition of culture often highlights what he or she studies. So there's a broad definition that says culture is behavior patterns shared by members of a community that rely on socially learned and transmitted information. It's a very broad definition. Many scholars of human culture would dismiss it as absurdly inclusive. A broad definition like this is useful, however, because it helps us understand the evolutionary roots and spread of culture in humans and other species. Many types and grades of culture are included within that definition. Those types and grades are important and interesting, but more important and interesting is the whole phenomenon of culture, the flow of information independent of genetic inheritance. Like Jim said, nature versus nurture. The authors like this next definition from cultural theorists Peter Richardson and Robert Boyd, who say information capable of affecting individuals' behavior that they acquire from other members of their species through teaching, imitation, and other forms of social transmission. So there seems to be talk of information and behavior. And so what is it? Is culture the information itself, or is it the behavior that's created, or is it both of those? The major difference between these definitions is whether culture is the information that affects the behavior, or if it's the behavior resulting from the information. An understanding of this distinction between knowledge and behavior, between what we know and what we do, is still being worked out. While human culture can be stored in books or bytes or buildings, most cultural information, and that important part that it actually affects how we behave, resides in our brains. And the final definition that they come to after exploring all these different permutations of what culture, how you could define it, is culture is information or behavior shared within a community which is acquired from conspecifics through some form of social learning. So if you're like me, you're heading to the dictionary to figure out what conspecifics means. It means a member of the same species. So these authors think that it is information and behavior. And so I'm going to go back to my question that I'm hoping to get some calls on, and maybe I'll go to a music break to let you formulate your response. But here we go. This information or these behaviors, which ones are important to you? Which ones give you your life meaning? Which ones give your life purpose? Well, that got someone's attention. Hi, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Graham. Hey, I so much appreciate the program. It's my intellectual workout for the week every week.
Very good.
Anyhow, things I like or don't like about culture. Aggression I really don't like. And my next comment isn't meant to be anti-religion, but I sure wish that people lived up to the principles that their religion principally addresses. I don't see really that that's happening very much right now. The thing I like about culture is learning, arts, all of them, dance, music, all of the arts. I guess that's sort of the long or the short of my reply.
So it sounds like just the concept of learning itself as a cultural element of our lives. You know, you're a teacher, right?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No.
Remind me what you did for a career. You're retired now, right?
Oh, I had several careers.
Oh, fun.
Okay. I was an art dealer for a number of years.
Cool. There's some culture there.
There was a lot of culture there. It was fabulous. I treasure my collection of art. I look at it every day. It brings me stories like reading a chapter of a book or seeing a part of a movie. You know, it's just fascinating stuff, and I really appreciate having it. Then, of all things, I was a land use consultant for 20-plus years. So I had a art and legal background. I absorbed it, and it's enriched my life, and I hope others as well. So that's what I did in life. Amongst a few other wacky things.
Yeah, well, there must have been some cultural implications in land use as well, huh?
Oh, absolutely. It's amazing. You know, I mostly represented rural people, either groups or individuals, who are being kicked off their land by, I think, very oppressive and backward-thinking policies. You know, I live in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a very interesting phenomenon that happened. And what I found is that the politicians in charge of these policies were actually playing to their urban constituents. And they didn't give a rip about what they did to negatively affect the lives of actual rural residents. Most rural residents had several jobs. They might do landscaping. They might do masonry. They might do irrigation, all kinds of different things, embroidery even. They went from job to job almost seasonally.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of wiped their ability to live out. And I thought, wow, they're not paying attention, or maybe they don't care, but they were playing to their urban constituents. And I'm not downplaying respect for the environment whatsoever, not at all. But I don't think they were thinking of the context of how what they were doing was really prying the bread out of families' mouths.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a balance there, and I don't think it even has been struck at this time. I don't see the balance.
Well, it's hard to balance the scales when one side is a city and the other side is a rural community. There's just no way to really balance that out.
Listening helps.
True, yeah. And representation helps.
Exactly. And I think those things kind of failed us back in time here in Washington State. I think Oregon has a similar kind of situation they've gone through, too. But, no, I don't think people were being represented properly, and I don't think that people were listening properly, and it kind of wound up in a catastrophe, a real catastrophe. We lost the urban culture, or the rural culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they transformed it into the next place to build a great big housing project.
Mm-hmm.
For urbanites, I actually heard people who bought homes in these home site building projects, who complained about the manure sprinklers. My kid is choking at the bus stop. Oh my God, This has got to stop. And they actually reacted to that kind of stuff.
It's like moving to the prairie and complaining you can't see the mountains.
Yeah, well, anyhow, I've had an interesting background, and I truly appreciate, like I said, this is my mental gymnastics for the week, listening to the program, listening to the call-ins, and listening to you.
Well, thanks for chiming in this week, as always. It's great to hear from you.
Okay, I just wanted, this is a great, great conversation. It is.
Yeah, we'll keep it going.
Call in. Okay.
Take care, Paul.
Bye.
And we've got another caller. Hi, good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Graham. How are you doing?
Doing good. Your voice sounds familiar.
Yeah, I just live up the hill from the radio station.
Very nice. What are your thoughts for today?
I had the privilege of spending 2 years living with a mountain tribe in the Philippines, in the southern Philippines. And I would recommend to anyone to learn more about their culture, to live for a while in another culture, to see what the differences are. It's a real experience. I think it's helped a lot of people who've lived overseas to see how their culture works and how, by contrasting it with another culture. Most of the Philippines operates on a system of getting along with others, it leads to things like four lanes of traffic, reducing two lanes going each way. When the traffic gets real oppressive in one direction, the traffic goes down to one lane on the other side of the road. It was very disconcerting to me because we live in a culture that's, to a big extent, rule-bound, and having people coming at you when you're driving in a lane that should be for you can be disconcerting and maddening in a way, but everybody gets along.
I'm sure there's no
culture.
There's no automated barriers that go up as the lanes change, and it's all just a system of...
When the traffic pressure increases, everybody just moves over and lets the... lets the traffic go the other way, and nobody gets upset. And then it's a cultural thing. The cities are pretty packed, so people learn to give way to each other to a much larger extent than we do in our culture. I would see tourists come and do all these little things that that point out that they are from another culture. They stand out. It's a great privilege to be able to live in another culture and see how it contrasts with your own.
Can I ask you a question about that? You mentioned, you know, living in the mountain village in the Philippines and noticing the contrasts. Did you notice those, like, significantly more than similarities? Were there similarities as well? Were there very few? The contrasts kind of outweighed the compares?
Oh yeah, the contrasts were it took a lot of rethinking how I approached working with other people to be able to work well with this group. That they lived very, very much closer to nature, of course, and a lot of that influenced how they did things. Small villages, people are intimately connected, and for instance, if there's a recalcitrant member of society, they are brought back into the fold by threatening to kick them out of the village. Living alone in the jungle is almost certain death. So you learn to get along with all of the people in your community, and if you don't, if you get if you get banished, you're out. And it showed up when the outside world started creeping in, and there were opportunities for a tribal member to leave the tribal group and find a living in the settling communities that were moving into the area, then that whole culture started to break down. Mm-hmm. Because the people who were not following the culture as closely didn't face the threat of banishment from the culture, because they had an alternative to go and live in the settlement communities. So it was a way of eroding the culture.
Yeah, this is an interesting piece of this, because, as you know, the definitions of culture that I was talking about refer a lot to the communities within which this transmission of information or behavior takes place. And we're at this tipping point where there's an introduction of a new form of culture, which is the global community, with global,
right,
global travel, global shipping, global communication. You know, you can't really draw the same boundaries that you used to draw, and some cultures get swallowed up or destroyed. Some get stronger. You know, some of those pockets will always stay individualized, but there's kind of this, like, meta layer of culture that's forming right now.
And a lot of travelers try to seek out those cultures that are isolated and unique, and in a way, by overpowering them, can lead to their destruction. So it's a difficult balance. I remember a group of travelers coming through the area where I was working. I won't describe the nationalities, but there were four guys, three from one country and one from another, who decided to go back into the rainforest to hunt out a group called the Tassadai. They got to another village, and the villagers gave them a little hut to sleep in the night, and they all gathered in the hut, the villagers and the four travelers. And the three travelers from one country got into a big argument about who had paid the last fare on the public transport that they used. And the guy from the other country started looking around and noticed that all the villagers were kind of backing away from these guys, because in their culture, when you raise your voice, the next thing that happens is the knives come out.
Mm-hmm.
So they were assuming that these guys were getting ready to have a big fight to the death. And the guy from the single country kept admonishing these guys, say, "Hey, you're really freaking these people out." And, of course, they weren't listening, and the villagers just fled and left them all by themselves in this little hut. So they destroyed the contact with this group because they hadn't understood the culture well enough. That happens. It happens a lot.
Yeah, one of my questions was, what are some aspects of culture that we would be proud to show an outsider, and which ones would we be embarrassed by? And I think that just, you know, to the word cultural insensitivity doesn't really quite cover it, but our competitiveness, our self-destructiveness, our inability to cooperate interculturally would be a source of embarrassment for me.
Yeah. Well, it's too long a discussion to spend on the radio for the time that you have, but just thought I'd throw in a few thoughts.
Well, I'm glad you did. Thanks for calling.
Okay.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 503-325-0010. I love hearing from the regulars, and I love hearing from first-time callers as well. Does the topic of culture pique your interest, and do you have some thoughts that you'd like to share with your community? It's kind of fun. You'll like it. Don't be nervous. Don't be shy. 503-325-0010. One of the things that's been crossing my mind a lot in terms of what we've been experiencing as a country around issues of race and equity and justice is the nature of being in the minority group versus being in the majority group, and what that means, what that does, and if you are in a majority group, have you had an experience of being in a minority group? I think this is kind of hitting on what gets thrown around as white privilege and white fragility, and your fragility will be exposed if you become a minority for the first time in your life when you're used to being in the majority. I'm delighted to tell you that we have another caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
I would like to talk about the cultural shift that happened during the 1970s.
Okay.
It was a time when the women's movement crested, the African-American movement crested, and AIM, the American Indian movement, crested, which gave opportunities in education and professional opportunities to these marginalized groups that had never had the eye of the country before. And it also fomented lots of activity. For example, they established the Women's Museum of Art in Washington, D.C. They established the American Indian Museum in part of the Smithsonian system. They had all kinds of cultural activities on the East Coast and the Midwest that highlighted the African-American history in this country. We had a program on television called Roots, Alex Haley, that really galvanized people and making them realize that there were other people, except, you know, more people than just your white, you know, people. And I see that period as a very important part of our history. And people go, what happened, you know, in the 70s, you know, you talk to most men that are in their 60s, 70s, you know, nothing happened in the 70s. Well, they weren't part of the action.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a very important part of the change in the culture of the United States.
I like your use of the word crested, and I'd like you to explore what you mean by that as far as, you know, was that just sort of the peak of activity, and then we're still in a trough, or where, you know, what do you see?
Actually, it was a crest of a wave that took us somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
into a better place.
Mm, good.
Before that time. And also, we had legislation in the Congress. There was Title IX, and that meant that in high school, or any school that was a public school that had federal funds going to it, they had to give opportunities, equal opportunities, to both the boys and the girls. And so in 1972, that was enacted, which meant that, darn it, I didn't get to be on the girls' basketball team because I graduated then. But it did offer the opportunity for me to go into an architecture program at a state school and be totally welcomed, which was very hard for women before that. There were about 9 women in my program, and it was wonderful because we had things that we contributed to the thought process of the classes that the guys didn't have, and the guys gave us stuff that we didn't have. It was wonderful. I mean, the fact that we can mix up people in this country and learn from everyone else is the beauty of America. And so that's why when we have cultures that are recognized, it's really important because their perspective can give us another view.
So you see the variation in perspectives and viewpoints as being one of the really healthy aspects of a multicultural society.
Yes, I do.
So I love your comment about the 70s and the crest in those movements. And those, to me, sort of represent the righting of wrongs. And I want to challenge you to come up with an aspect of culture that you feel like is just inherently good. Like, what are some aspects of culture that you find, beauty or power or resonance with?
Architecture.
That's a good one, architecture.
When you think about the cathedrals and how long in Europe they took to build, 300 years, that's generation after generation. Those generations were teaching the future generations the skills, the flying buttress, the lever systems, the physics of building with stone, lifting materials 10 stories up with fulcrums and pulleys. And the architecture, the buildings we live in influence our behavior. And people don't realize that. The way we lay out our cities and towns, the way our infrastructure is maintained, the way our power, our water, our food comes to us, this is all cultural, and it all influences the creativity and the thought processes if you engage that. Because everything we surround ourselves with influences the way we behave. And many people are clueless to this.
Yeah, I mean, one example that comes to mind is what our schools are like for kids, and are they inspired by the architecture? Are the chairs comfortable? Are they content in their physical space when they're doing this important act of learning?
Oh, exactly. I have a master's in education, and I'm very glaringly aware of this, especially in high schools. And I think there's more tenderness given to children in elementary school, and then that disappears once kids get into junior and high school.
Well, you got to prepare them for the real world, you know.
Yeah, I know. Life is tough. I realize that. But I think that an educational environment, the way it's structured, is extremely important.
Agreed.
Yeah. And the length of the classes. One thing that I was really upset about, this has to do with, the length of people can only learn in certain amounts of time. If you have a class that is going to be 2 hours long, unless it's a very involved class, like you're doing auto body repair or you're doing art or you're doing some complex process, people can't just sit and listen and watch for more than like 40 minutes. And when meetings continually go on and on and on, people lose their track of thought. They lose their passion for being participatory. I'm sorry, I'm going out on a limb.
It took me a long time to realize that my brain functions very differently at different parts of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Right when I wake up, not so much. An hour later, pretty good. End of the day, waning.
Yeah, I'm different. I come right out of the gate thinking.
For me, it's after the second cup of coffee.
Okay.
Well, I really appreciate your thoughts. That was a great call. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Graham. Bye.
Bye. And we've got another caller. Good morning.
Hello there.
Oh, sounds like you got a radio on in the background there.
I will turn it off.
Thank you.
Although I love the echo.
Yeah. very psychedelic.
Okay, well, a couple of thoughts. I really appreciated the woman who was just on. I totally agree with the concept of architecture and how it affects us. I'm a fan of Buckminster Fuller, who did the geodesic domes. I have a geodesic dome here at my farm, and how it affects one's consciousness. And even, I think it was attributed to an English person. He said, you know, we build our houses, and then the houses build us, which I thought was pretty prescient. The one thing I did want to talk about, though, or share with you and your audience, has to do with a book by William Irwin Thompson called The Time Falling Bodies Take to Light. And his hypothesis in the book was that new ideas, new consciousness, new ways of doing things literally are an energetic field that comes into humanity. And it takes time for those fields of consciousness to reveal themselves. And it's the artists, the painters, the sculptors, the musicians — I'm a musician, so I know it very well — to give expression to this energy that we are experiencing. And later, as the general public begins to feel that energy and to see how artists display their response to it, then that field can kind of take on a power of its own, you might say.
That is a fascinating concept. It reminds me of how many great songwriters or composers talk about going into sort of a — they lie on the couch and fall half asleep, and then that's when the ideas come to them. And so many artists do not attribute their inspiration to themselves. They attribute it to something external to themselves.
Yeah, I've always had difficulty, you know, due again to the culture having to say, this is mine, or I did this. But I'm just a tool for consciousness to come through me. In the very beginning, I said, I was in a desperate place, and I said, okay, Lord, whoever, whatever you are, make me an instrument of the wind. And I became a flute player.
Nice. So. Well, I've thought about doing a whole show on our Buckminster Fuller as well. He's one of my favorites. And just his general attitude that we can work cooperatively and fulfill everyone's needs and more, rather than competitively and destructively.
Yeah, he was definitely tuned in and turned on in many, many different ways. I've recently become more aware of what people call sacred geometry. Mm-hmm. And he was definitely using it, the icosahedron, the tetrahedron. All of those shapes and forms supposedly are sacred geometric shapes that help us to navigate through our lives. But yeah, that would be a great show. I definitely appreciate it. I actually had the opportunity of having lunch with him.
Oh, wow.
A year before he died, I was doing a concert tour in Alaska, and the people that were putting him on wanted to use my sound system that I had brought for my concert. Mm-hmm. I said, sure, as long as I can, you know, sit in the driver's seat of the sound system. So I got to sit and listen to him for 3 hours. Afterwards, I went up to him because I had sent him my very first album that I had ever recorded years ago, before then. And I said, hi, I'm Larkin. I sent you an album a long time ago. I said, oh, yes, I remember you. Hmm. And he actually hand-wrote me a response letter, which was interesting. He said, people are just now learning how to hear the music that you're playing. And it was meditative music at the time. Mm-hmm. So he said, how would you like to have lunch with me tomorrow? And I said, sure. So I met him at his hotel the next day, and we sat and talked for a couple hours. It was mind-blowing, just wonderful.
I'm curious to hear more about what meditative music means to you.
Well, that's what it was called. It was just my music coming through me. I learned how to hook my heart up with my hands and bypass my brain so that my music comes through so that it soothes me. soothing quality to my energies, you might say. Therefore, it became meditative. My first album was 60 minutes of solo flute music. And when I was in the recording studio, I was very brand new to the whole system of recording. So I asked the engineer, I said, can I just turn out the lights and light this candle? And he said, yeah, sure. So they turned out the lights, I lit a candle, and I played my feelings or my energy with that candle. And so the name of the album became To the Essence of a Candle. And it was extremely meditative and very peaceful, and people used it for all kinds of reasons.
So to what extent was that album fully improvised, or had you composed some of it? Or
no. All of my material, even when I play themes that I've created now over again, like on Hammer Dulcimer, it's all improvisational. I live at that edge of creativity. Some people talk about it all comes through. It's all new. It's not. I can perform other pieces, like now at Christmas time. You know, I love Christmas carols. Mm-hmm. I can play Christmas carols on the flute. But most of the time, I have to just kind of go in and I play one note, and then the next note follows that, whatever it comes through. The way I used to do my concerts was I would ask the audience to make a sound, any sound. And all of the audience members making their own sound actually created there was a tonic there, a single note in the chord of the audience, you might see. And I would find that note on my flute and play an improvisation to the audience with that. And what that did for me, and I think for the audience, was it put me in tune with them for the rest of the evening.
That's really cool. Have you studied raga music at all, Indian raga?
I haven't studied it. You know, I definitely appreciate it. Sachdev was one of my mentors and a flutist.
That particular style and school of music seems to me one of the things that I would want to make sure that an alien anthropologist saw when they came to visit Earth. I don't pretend to understand raga, but I know that it's a deep, you know, there's a lot of depth to that form. And a lot of it's improvisational too, which is what made me think of it when hearing you talk about your process.
That's interesting. I didn't know that it was improvisation. I thought it was very highly structured in an Indian culture.
Well, that's a good question. Like I said, I don't pretend to know a lot about it, but I think there's at least elements of improvisation, and there may be structure as well.
I'm sure there was and is.
And like the way that, you know, the tabla thing, those, that's complex and structured. And but yeah,
it is. And at the same time, if you watch a tabla player, they get lost in what they're doing. You know, they get into that reverie where you're just flowing with whatever it is that's coming through you.
Yeah, it's interesting to have to work that hard to get to reverie, though, because those folks probably practice 8 hours a day, you know, for years and years and years to get to that point where they can let it all go.
Yeah, well, that reminds me of something that Duke Ellington said when he was talking to some new music students. He said, my advice to you is, after you graduate, forget everything you've learned and just play.
Yeah, that's great. Well, any last thoughts on culture for us this morning?
Oh, goodness gracious. I think we are all being urged to move forward into a more peaceful, understanding, and cooperative way of living on planet Earth, because Mother Earth needs us to align our culture with her. And I believe that that is coming very slowly, but that's our future.
I'm writing that down because it's so good. Yeah, I think that the Earth needing us to align our culture to her strikes me very much as what you referred to before as an energetic field that takes time to reveal itself. And so thank you for doing your part to help.
I'm trying, and thank you for doing your show.
Merry Christmas.
I'm really appreciative.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Blessings.
Bye. little less than 10 minutes left in the show. It's been a fun one today to sink our teeth into what culture is and what aspects of it are healthy or positive, what aspects can be negative, what it means to be in a global culture. But we've got time for a few more calls. We've got one coming in now. Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Graham. Just a small item. Wonderful calls this morning. Thank you. Just a small item. I think we organize culture around our basic needs. And so you see that trade has defined different cultures. Or when you go to when a woman or, you know, women, we're shoppers. So I think we have shopping cultures. Some people shop at Nordstrom's. Some people shop at Target. Some people go to Walmart. Some people insist that they must go to Costco because of Walmart's policies. But I lived a year in England, and in London, all of the little burgs were organized around a little town square, and there was the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to buy your bread and your meat and your vegetables for that meal, and you had a small refrigerator. And we have these mega box stores here. So I think trade is a way that we organize our culture, and I think it's the way we're attracted to it too. How have the shopkeepers organized their shops? You know, are they alluring? How, you know, what kind of flavor do they have? So it's just a small item, but kind of an important one. I particularly love the architecture discussion as well. So I think that's all I got.
Yeah, that's a good one too. I mean, there's architecture involved in these stores, and so I guess to sum up your comment, big box stores versus the baker and the butcher and the candlestick maker, do you long for those days, or do you think big box and internet shopping's good? Where is this all headed? What are we?
Well, just one other side note here. In, you know, if we lack community organizations, you know, there used to be a town, you know, a town center where people got their information, where people would gather. And in Europe, there's always a town center, and people organized around that. I think we lack that kind of cohesive gathering place. You know, community centers or senior centers are falling away because our culture has become so 9 to 5. We've got the mother and the father working in every household just to sustain themselves, sustain the family. So I think we're losing some cultural elements that are kind of sad. So religious institutions gather once a week. So that seems to be, even those are dwindling. So the artifacts, what are the artifacts of our culture? Box stores? Yuck. Yuck.
So what struck me when you were saying that was how profit-driven everything is and how money-centric everything is. You know, the decisions that we make, the places that we build, the ways that we gather. I'm trying to think of a gathering that doesn't have somebody's bottom line attached to it.
Yeah, we've lost all of the, you know, even, my husband and I love to dance. You know, and we, back in the 30s and 40s, there were dance halls everywhere, places to people to gather. And they were innocent. They weren't drunken ball, you know, there might have been drinking involved, but they weren't, you know, they didn't have to be bars. You know, they were places to gather to enjoy a cultural experience. I remember to go into polkas with my grandmother, you know, you know, German polkas. You know, and everybody sat in chairs along the walls. I mean, it was a place where the community gathered, where we, you know, got to see everybody dressed up, and there weren't factions. So we're losing our communities. We our communities are shopping centers. So that's maybe kind of sad.
Yeah, and your point about dance clubs and how that it used to just be about fun. I regret to say that when I was a kid and went to dance clubs, the word that I would just, you know, use to describe that experience is just that everything is oversexed. Everything is about sex.
Well,
you know, the forms of dancing and the reasons people find themselves in those places. I didn't fit in. Not that I don't like sex.
Well, it is a big part of our civilization, you know, a love of sex, of procreation. That's how we reproduce. So,
mm-hmm.
And there was a way to meet people,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
Where do you meet people now?
Right.
Where do we meet people? So, you know, it's all kind of, I think a sad, we're losing some sad, we're losing our community. We need to figure out how to build communities again. And in hunter-gatherer societies, they needed each other. They had to gather in communities just to support one another. You know, just to, you know, who had this, who made the bread, and who made the, you know, who found the deer or, you know, picked the vegetables for the day. So,
yeah, there's a significant degree of equality in those, you know, where even if you are the one that gets the deer, everybody gets the same amount of it for dinner that night.
And we all shared what we had. So it was a community sharing. So anyway, thank you for your program again and great comments.
Yeah, great show today. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Well, I will echo everyone's sentiments about what a great bunch of calls we got today. Heck, we've got another minute. We've got another caller. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Steve.
Hey, Steve.
For the icebreaker, it's hard to decide whether it's Yogi Bear or Foghorn Leghorn.
A couple of characters.
For me. Yeah. But sure. I wanted to comment on a thought that I had about Maslow. He talks about a hierarchy of needs, of course, but he also talked about this desire that each of us have to go beyond our parents in our consciousness to develop. He had the idea that we naturally want to move forward and be something beyond what our parents were. And this gives me optimistic hope that maybe someday a generation, a couple generations down, will say, war, that's so passe, that's the last decade. We think differently now. We think that peace is more important and seeking the transpersonal. What do you think of that?
Well, take the profits out of war and it'll become very popular, very unpopular very quickly.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I think peace is pretty popular with people, but war is pretty popular with profiteers.
Yeah.
That's just my cynical look at it.
I agree. I think that once you become more self-actualized, though, that was one of the highest levels of the pyramid for his hierarchy of needs. Is that transpersonal is a possibility, you know, connecting with the creative force that is beyond human personality. And I think cultures are all seeking that, but it's kind of difficult to attain. So anyway.
Yeah, maybe there's power dynamics, you know, that prevent cultures from getting what they want.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, Steve, we got to let it go there, but I really appreciate you ringing in.
Thanks a lot.
Have a great day.
Have a nice day.
You're listening to KMUN Astoria, KTCB Tillamook, and online at coastradio.org. Stay tuned for headline news for the next 5 minutes, followed by Wednesday morning music with your host, Jerry Middaugh. Thanks to our callers. Great show today, everyone. Really enjoyed it.